Hi, it's Joanne.
Hi, Joanne. How are you?
I'm good, Ed. How are you?
I'm hanging in there.
Yes.
That's about all I can say.
Yeah. It's a pretty frantic time right now.
We got a lot going on.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
I'm just seeing who's on the WebEx, marking down their name.
I'm trying to get on. This is Jennifer.
Hi, Ed. This is Kirsty. I am here, but I'm also having issues with WebEx. It's been circulating for about 5 minutes.
Oh, I had the same problem. It says underneath there, if you need immediate access, to press there. And then it'll load up another file.
Maybe I should just try again. Can you do that?
Hey, John Hannigan is on. Hello. John, how are you?
I'm good. How are you all?
Hanging in there. Dale and Bill are on.
Your screen, join meeting. I don't know what I'm
doing. How is everybody today?
We could not be better. It's a glorious day.
We had 10 minutes of sunshine in Detroit today.
Wow.
There you go, finally.
Hello, NIAAA is here.
Hey, guys.
Bill Dunphy, Dale Harrell.
Hey, Dale. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Bill.
Hi.
Is there supposed to be anything on the screen at this point?
No. Not yet.
It just should say CIFSD moderator.
Okay, good. All right.
Meeting number.
Okay. I'm not missing any really cute pictures or, you know, colorful graphics or anything. That's good.
I should have put my
picture. Coming later.
Yes, that's it.
Kirsty, did you get on?
Bill Barnett.
It looks like I'm getting there.
Bill.
Hello.
Tina?
Yep.
Peter Hammond? Johan?
I am here.
Joanne's on. Kirsty Donald's on. Tom Donaldson or Kathy Mitchell?
Yeah, Ed. Hi, Tom. I'm here.
Hi.
Hi, Ed. It's Michael.
Michael. God, everybody's here. Ken Jones is the only one absent?
No, he's here.
All right, Ken. Everybody's here. Peter Hammond? Not yet. Leah? Okay. Well, we got almost everybody. And what we thought we'd do today is that CFAS 3 is still running and functioning. And
hello, this is Helen.
Hi, Helen. And Kirsty Donald is scheduled today to present a little bit. Maybe having a little problem getting on. I see her listed as being on, but Kirsty, I don't know.
I'm here. I'm on.
You're on. Okay.
And I am on you.
So Kirsty, what I have is an idea for her to present, like we have on a normal monthly conference call to have one of the investigators present their data. And I asked Kirsty just to present some of her data and see where we go. And then, at the start at least, and get hopefully through a lot of it, asking projects to take about 5 minutes and explain where they are in their project, and what are their best findings to date. And everybody prepared a few slides, and I'm doing that kind of opportunistic because I need to present at the reverse site visit that's coming up what CPAS has done, and I'd like to make a very good impression on the reviewer. And so I'm going to kind of cut and paste some of the stuff that you're going to present today and put it into slides so that I can use them at the reverse site visit. So I'm not sure we'll get through everybody today, but we'll get as far as we can, and those that we don't get today, we will make up on our next conference call on the 22nd. So are there any questions about CFAS or what we're going to try to do? Anybody? All right. Kirstie, can you take over the screen and from there?
I can. Just remind me what I need to put to... Okay, how do I share the screen here?
Under the Quick Start tab, there's a bubble that says Share File. You want to share your screen. So more options, Share Screen.
I think it's coming up.
While that's happening, Ed, we could have had a picture of you today. Isn't today your birthday?
Today is my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Happy birthday to you. To you. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday
to you.
That was terrible.
That was really not very well coordinated.
We obviously need a conductor.
Or a
saxophone player, or a pianist, or something.
I think you're wrong. We need an oboist.
You do know that these are conversations are all recorded.
Well, that's one to be proud of, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Kirstie, she can see your WebEx, so you can stop messing with that. You just want to click on your PowerPoint, and then we'll see that first.
Okay.
Yeah, so
Yeah, we can
trying.
See it.
It's coming.
There we go.
So we're seeing your screen. We don't need to see it through. You don't need to do anything in WebEx. You just operate your screen now.
Fantastic.
Okay.
There we go.
Can you see me? Where do you see me go?
We're good. Okay. I can see it, but you need to speak up.
Okay. I'll hold my phone a bit closer. Okay. So I'm, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Kirstie Donald, and I'm based here in Cape Town. And today I'm just going to give you an overview of the study and the sub-study which CFAS has funded as part of a developmental project. But every time I present some of the data on the project, I've had a lot of questions about the umbrella study that the sub-study is embedded in. So I'm going to talk in a little bit more detail today about the umbrella study and what kind of things are being done on the umbrella study so you have a better context for when I go on to the detail of what we're doing, and then a little bit on the process and where we've got to with the two-year-olds. So the title of the presentation today is Imaging the Developing Brain in Prenatal Alcohol Exposure. So the umbrella study is called the Drakenstein Child Health Study, and it's a multi-year birth cohort study which is following 1,200 mother infant dyads in the Drakenstein subdistrict, which is a semi-rural area about 50 kilometers outside of Cape Town Center. And the objective is to look at the risk and, in fact, resilience factors for child health and development in general. So the mothers and then the infants are followed up from the second trimester, about 20 to 28 weeks gestation, they recruited. The original umbrella study is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation up to 5 years of age, but we've heard last week that we have at least one extra year. So we have the children up until 6 years of age. They have very intensive visits during the first year of life at 6, 10, 14 weeks, 6, 9, and 12 months, and thereafter 6 monthly all the way through now to 6 years. And risk factors and general impacts are looked at in environmental areas, microbiological, nutritional, psychosocial, immunological, genetic, our study falls under the psychosocial area, or the psychosocial arm. There's a little bit more about the study location. So Paarl is a semi-rural area about 50 to 60 k's out of Cape Town. There are quite high levels of poverty and unemployment, but really in terms of South Africa and Africa in general, it's really low middle income area. There's quite good primary healthcare infrastructure. There's very high vaccine coverage. And we primarily use enrollment at two clinics, one which is known as TC Newman, where it was predominantly draws from community that is of mixed race, and one it's called Mbekweni, which primarily draws from a population of African ancestry, and all births are in the local district hospital. And the split between the two sites is approximately 50-50. It's a really stable population in general, and there's excellent retention and follow-up and strong buy-in from the community. So this is a picture. It just gives you an idea of the kind of housing. So it's a mixture of shack dwellings and more formal brick dwellings that the community lives in. This is just a schematic which gives you an idea of the different arms of the study and all the different areas or background information that feeds into the outcomes that are being measured. I'm going to go into a little bit more depth. So for us in the psychosocial area, we do look in quite a lot of depth at the maternal sociodemographics. We look at birth planning and partner support, psychosocial distress and mental health, with depression in particular, and then, of course, alcohol and other substance abuse, including smoking, and that's biological as well as questionnaire sampling, and then a whole battery of questionnaires around trauma, intimate partner violence, and other life stressors. There's also a large group of the mums who have formal neurocognitive testing and neuroimaging. And then for the infants, we do physical measures, but they follow that from a developmental and cognitive point of view, both in terms of formal development and cognition, as well as the more kind of socio-emotional aspects. Neuroimaging on a subgroup, which I'll talk to in more detail in a minute, mother-infant interactions, both videoing and eye tracking, and then some biological sampling, which looks at substance exposure as well as a genetic approach. So in a little bit more detail then, and I can give these slides to Ed for anybody who wants to look at it in more detail. This is the detail of the questionnaires that are given at the different times. So there's an element of repeat measures, certainly on the mums and to a lesser extent on the infants. So to give you an idea, in the subgroup, so about a quarter of the cohort, we have imaging on them at
2 to 4 weeks of age, and as part of this developmental project, we are imaging them again at between 2 and 3 years of age. But in addition, those infants have had formal developmental assessments at 6 months and at 2 years, and they're having formal neurocognitive assessments at 3.5 and 5 years. They also have hair cortisol at 3 years and eye tracking at 3 years as well, looking at motion regulation. So to look in a little bit more detail at the infants at the imaging sub-study, we have, as you know, acquired data on 236 infants aged 2 to 4 weeks. A group of about 70 who were alcohol exposed, moderate to severe alcohol exposure, a group of relatively healthy controls or squeaky clean, and there is a group in there who do have clinical depression, and that overlaps both the alcohol exposed and the so-called healthy controls. The scan modalities we did on the neonates were a structural MRI. We did diffusion tensor imaging, magnetic resonance spectroscopy, looking particularly at the parietal white and gray matter, and in particular glutamate and glutamine, and then resting state functional connectivity. Just to give you a taste, and many of you have seen this data before, we found overall decreased total gray matter volume in the alcohol-exposed infants compared to the controls. And then over and above the global gray matter, there was further decrease in various areas in the deep gray, including the amygdala, left thalamus, and left hippocampus. And this really is in line with the findings that have been reported in children at older age groups. I'm not talking about all the other modalities at the moment. They have been published, but I'll give you the bottom line in a minute. But just to give you an idea of the other clinical outcomes which we have looked at in association with the, in correlating with the imaging, we've looked at the Dubovitz neurological scale, which was administered at 2 to 4 weeks. And it looks at things like jitteriness and controllability, as well as the more kind of physical aspects of development at that age. And then the full assessment of the Bayley's scales of infant and toddler development at six months and at 2 years. We did find correlations between our imaging and the clinical outcomes, and this really adds to the problem with neonatal imaging is that MRI, as you know, is based on water diffusion. I mean, DTI is based on water diffusion, and there's a lot of water in neonatal brains, and one just wants to make sure that what you're seeing is real. And obviously, if what your findings correlate with what other people have found in other cohorts, that's reassuring, but it's also quite nice to see it correlate with clinical outcomes. Just to give you a summary of what we found in across all the modalities in the neonatal age group, so we found these structural volume changes. In the DTI, we found altered axial diffusivity in the major tracts linking frontal, temporal, and parietal regions. We found altered glutamate in the parietal white matter, suggesting delayed oligodendrocyte maturation. And then we found higher intrinsic connectivity in sensory motor networks, including thalamic, striatal, and parietal networks, suggesting delayed or certainly altered development of these networks in alcohol-exposed infants. So where does that leave us now? At the moment, we are further looking at trying to put these things together, because it's all very well to look at these modalities in isolation, but it's the value of having multiple modalities is to try and put them together in some way. So we are trying to look at a comparative analysis of the structural and functional connectivity in alcohol-exposed infants compared to controls using the graph analysis approach, and looking at just the at the moment the resting state connectivity using this approach. There do appear to be differences between the control and the alcohol exposed group, and we're still busy with the structural connectivity using the DTI. So really, we think that this does demonstrate bottom-up development and integration of networks being suboptimal, certainly altered in alcohol-exposed infant compared to controls. And this may relate initially to disruptive axon development and myelination. It's unclear at this stage exactly, and that's what is a huge value in following it up. So that was one of the key rationales for wanting to scan the children at a later age. And so we have started scanning them at age 2. And you can see there's a huge difference between infants, what the MRI looks like in the neonatal brain and the 2-year-old brain. It's much, much easier to look at 2-year-olds. And to give you an idea in real terms, so we've had of the older age group, of the 2 to 3 year olds, we've now had 70 come to the scanner. On average, they're about 2.5 now. There are differences in weight and head circumference, which is perhaps not unexpected. We don't have an even spread of males and females at this stage, but we're hoping that's going to even out as we add on to this cohort. We also don't have even amounts of smoking between the groups, which is also something which I think has been described many times before. But that's what it looks like so far with the ones that we have got at the 2-year-old age group. But we still have about another 100 of the children who have been imaged as neonates who are still lined up to be imaged. We're planning to do as many of those as we can to give ourselves the best chance of getting good and real outcomes. And just to sort of also give you a taster, we also have some genetic data on these particular infants. So we have genotyping already processed on 150 of the infants, and a further 190 are being sent off in the coming months. So we should have all the infants that were imaged genotyped. We already have all the infants that are imaged being analyzed for methylation, and we're hoping to have gene expression on the full lot. At the moment it's about half if you've got gene expression on. So coming back to what we're actually hoping to achieve here, what does our study add to the field? I think where we contribute is that there aren't a lot of imaging studies looking at these very early months and years of brain development, which is really critical. We all know that early child development, that the early years of child development lay the foundation for later academic and social outcomes. And I think that understanding things at this stage may help us in a variety of ways, which I'll go into in more detail in a moment. And the other thing where this cohort is perhaps particularly unique is that we have a huge amount, it's a very rich cohort in terms of the environmental, mental health, and other exposures that these mums have been, the mums and children are exposed to both before birth and and in the early years of development, and having that information available to be able to make sense of what we're seeing in a real world context, I think really has value. So that is maybe something that is new and relatively niche from what in terms of our study. But why is that important? I think that the study really resonates very well with a very key aim of CVAS, and that is identifying children who are affected by a prenatal alcohol exposure early. And Jeff Wozniak's work looking at what imaging markers can help us identify which children are going to have problems and which aren't, I think is a really valuable approach to using imaging. And I don't think that anybody is saying here that neuroimaging is going to be a scalable or desirable diagnostic tool necessarily for infants, for children who've been exposed to alcohol in terms of in clinical practice. But I think it can help us understand which of the clinical features are most important that we may be able to use early on to identify the children who are later affected. I think that secondly, understanding the trajectory of brain growth and development in these very early years can help us understand mechanisms, and particularly if we're able to link those with genetic changes and epigenetic changes across the generation, I think that is also a particularly unique and potentially helpful way of understanding what is going on in the brains of these young children. And building on that, what interventions we think are most likely to have impact in these early years of life, and it's always important to come back to that. What are the areas, what are the things that we think are going to make a difference, be it a behavioral intervention, be it a biological intervention, what are the areas that seem to be effective at this early age that we may be able to impact, and possibly in terms of studies looking at the effectiveness of interventions, are we able to mark the outcomes of the interventions using imaging? Because with the very sensitive modalities such as the white matter microstructural DTI approaches, and certainly the resting state and functional outcomes modality seem to be particularly sensitive. And then looking not only at risk factors for poor outcome, but also factors that make children who are exposed to alcohol more resilient. And having a group of children that we have from this very early age and be able to follow them into school age, I think we are wanting to look at what things we can identify that may help which children do well despite their background, and how we can help build that for communities in and at-risk children in terms of the intervention. So I think those are all opportunities that a study like this offers. And lastly, I just wanted to say a couple of words about why this particular study in a way is really outside of CFAS for so many reasons. I know CFAS has previously had an arm in South Africa, but in many ways this study is disarticulated from many of the others. But I think there is huge synergy. And although we're not going forward to CFAS 4, I think we're really hoping to keep the link because of the focus of CFAS in the broader global context for early identification, for understanding mechanisms, for targeting interventions and for looking at risk and resilience. So I think all of those things speak to the primary aims of a consortium. And I think that if we are able to keep those links, we really have an opportunity to contribute to the global initiative around these vulnerable children. So I think that just,
well, thank you very much.
I'm
sorry. Well, thank you very much, and I am looking forward to our continued collaborations and links between CFAS and your project. And I think it's quite remarkable the amount of data that you've managed to collect and the findings and the importance of those findings. Are there any really quick questions? Okay. Then I'm going to move on to what I'm trying to do. Shared the wrong screen here. All right, can everyone see that?
Yes.
All right, so what I'm trying to do, and this is for the admin core, is to kind of update where we are, and this is what I have so far of what we've managed to do during the last 4.5 years, is we published basically 114 papers. A majority involved multiple CFAS projects, and over 15% of those papers have CFAS listed as the author, in the authorship. So I think we've done pretty well, particularly as it relates to collaborative and overlap between the projects. We're still counting and trying to get information on the number of abstracts that people have presented. And so any information you can provide about meeting abstracts, which we really haven't collected, would be appreciated. And RSA will go through the meeting program and pull out and look at how many abstracts CFAS investigators gave at those meetings. But I imagine those two numbers are going to be rather large. And certainly, CFAS investigators had significant contributions in lots of high-impact journals. And if I'm missing something, please let me know. We've presented at the FASD meeting in Vancouver every other year for the last since 2012. This iteration of CFAS started. We've had RSA Symposium and ISBR-ESBR symposiums in Berlin. We have recruited a number of people to the field of FASD research by investigators, and I'm hoping that we can increase this more. I haven't received this information from everybody yet. And then what I'm really looking for now is basically what people think are their major advances. During the reverse site visit, I get about 20 minutes to say where we've been, what we've done. And so I need to be selective about what we do and what I put in here. But no one else will get to talk unless they're asked a question, and no one else will present slides. So that's what I'm looking for over the next half hour, and then on our next conference call, we won't get to everybody. So I'd like to ask if it's possible that maybe go in the order of Tina. We'll come back to the cores at the next call. Tina, Sarah, Elizabeth, Peter, and then Johan, if they can present just 5 minutes briefly what they think are the key accomplishments of what they've done in the last 4.5 years. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yep.
Any questions to the admin core? Okay. Then, Tina, can you get up and on?
So, tell me what I need to do.
Go to Quick Start and then share your screen.
Where is Quick? Oh, there it is, Quick Start.
Upper left corner.
Got it? Okay. And then share screen. Got it.
And then you should come up and I should go away, right?
Okay, do you see me?
I do.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so just reviewing the aims in the next 5 minutes, for phase three, we're to determine if the beneficial effects of the prenatal vitamin supplementation intervention in alcohol-exposed children persisted at preschool age, to determine if prenatal alcohol exposure in the context of this prenatal nutritional
environment. Excuse me, Tina, next, can I ask a question?
Sure.
I'm sorry. So is the point of this very brief presentation to go right to the highlights?
We were asked to list our aims, but if you want me to go right to the highlights, I can do that.
Yeah, I'd like to see what the findings are.
Okay, I'm skipping to the next slide.
I ask people for a lot of information because I have to put that into reports and things like that. But for this right now, if you had to get up in front of that reverse psychic and say, these are my major, this is what we did. This is our product.
Okay. So we demonstrated that the prevalence was high of in-pregnancy drinking in two regions of western Ukraine, and that tolerance for alcohol was the single best predictor of heavy episodic drinking in pregnancy in that population. We demonstrated that there was significantly better performance on the Bailey Mental Developmental Index in six-month-old infants whose mothers were allocated to receive the multivitamin mineral supplement intervention with or without choline, although we didn't see any additional benefit of choline given with the multivitamins. And then the cardiac orienting response measure of information processing was a good measure of prenatal alcohol exposure in 6 to 12-month-old infants who demonstrated impairment on that measure. And in that measure, prenatal choline supplementation with the multivitamin mineral supplement was associated with improved response to visual stimuli in both the alcohol-exposed group and in the comparison low unexposed group. We demonstrated that the core performed as well or better than the Bailey at 6 months of age to predict performance on the Bailey at 12 months of age, suggesting that this less difficult measure to administer might be a better tool to use in the field to be able to predict or to screen for alcohol-related deficits in very young children. We haven't completed the analysis, but there are just modest differences in some selective measures of preschool neurobehavioral testing battery for prenatal alcohol-exposed children whose mothers participated in the multivitamin mineral intervention trial. And that analysis is still going on. We showed that child nutritional status differed on plasma ferritin levels in prenatally exposed children with features of FASD compared to unexposed and those who had exposure but no evidence of FASD. And then we found 11 specific microRNAs measured in maternal plasma in the second and third trimester of pregnancy were associated with infants who were moderately to heavily exposed to alcohol and had physical and neurobehavioral features of FASD compared to unexposed, including clinical covariates. Oops, sorry. Including clinical covariates. In the analysis, correct classification of outcome, FASD outcome based on these microRNA measures was possible in 86% of the cases. And we demonstrated that 2D prenatal ultrasound measures of fetal frontothalamic and interorbital distances were significantly correlated with cardinal facial features of FASD and neurobehavioral performance in postnatal life, so second trimester routine ultrasound. And maternal depression in alcohol-consuming mothers in this sample was associated with neurobehavioral impairment in alcohol-exposed infants and may be a factor that exacerbates this effect and a focus for intervention. And then the rest of this is my products, the publications, and then the interactions of the various groups that we participated with in CFAS, over CFAS 3.
Tina, thank you. If you had to pick one of those things to highlight, as the, what do you think would be it?
It's probably the microRNA and the followed by the cardiac or antigen response, because that's the direction that we're going in phase four.
Okay, thank you. Sarah, can you take over?
Yes. Hold on, I'm just taking you guys off speakerphone. All right, so quick start.
Quick start. Share my screen. Share screen. And you're on.
Share screen.
You're on.
Are you seeing the right? You're seeing my. Now are you seeing my slides?
Yep.
Yep.
And again, just get right to the.
Yep.
The biggie.
I don't know what you're seeing, so I have two screens, so let me skip to highlights. So if you remember, our aims were to develop the decision tree to address the role of age in our results and to specifically examine memory functioning. So we...
Sarah, could you put it on show?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm trying... maybe. I thought I was on show, so...
Maybe you are.
Oh, you are now?
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank
so,
you.
Okay. So the we were successful in developing our decision tree, which we did using data that we collected in CFAST2. We created the tree with that data, then we validated it using another large database from CFAST3. In that, in the study, we used diverse comparison groups, so both CFAST2 and CFAST3 includes comparison subjects who have other behavioral conditions. And in the validation study, we were able to test whether it worked in both age groups, which is 5 to 7 and 10 to 16 years. Both of those things were successful. We were able to successfully identify 80% or higher of subjects with prenatal alcohol exposure with high sensitivity and specificity, and we recently published that paper in the Journal of Pediatrics, and we're very, very proud of it. And Ed, that would be my highlight. That would be my one highlight that I would want to have included, because it's also groundwork for what we're going to do in CFAST4 if we're successful in our funding. The other main aim was to address memory. Or to examine specific aspects of memory in people who have histories of prenatal alcohol exposure. And we did that in four different studies, one of which has been published. In that study, we looked at the relationship between prenatal alcohol exposure, age, and sex on multiple neuropsychological measures, including memory. Bottom line was that age and sex were not really important factors. Prenatal alcohol exposure, of course, was an important factor. We have two additional neuropsychological studies of memory that we're working on. Both of them are pretty close to being ready. One of them, the third bullet on here, Gross et al., is much closer. And we're hoping to submit that one, well, I don't know, it's touch and go if we're going to submit it before the site visit, but that's our goal. The second bullet is a paper that we did submit for publication. It's currently under review, and in that study we looked specifically at the California Verbal Learning Test, which is a well-established memory measure, and we looked at neural correlates of memory functioning. So those are our main highlights from CFAST3. We have a very recent one that some of you are already familiar with, because we submitted this as an abstract to RSA. Using CFAST3 data, we developed a risk score for prenatal alcohol exposure, and we were able to come up with a 5-point risk score, and we then categorized it as low, intermediate, and high. And you can see that high, using this risk score, we were able to accurately capture 85% of alcohol-exposed subjects in the high category and 85% in the low category. I have that completely wrong. Those two bars should be in the low, should be reversed, so that lighter color purple should be high and the darker color purple should be low in the low category, and in the intermediate category captured an equal number. And the risk score was
So we were able to accurately classify subjects with a high degree of sensitivity, but they also correlated with other important outcome variables of IQ and executive functioning. So we're really excited to pursue that study. These are our papers. We have two papers under review, so we've got our fingers crossed for that. And these are the papers we're working on, the abstracts and our interactions with other consortium members.
Okay, Sarah, what I'm assuming you'd say that the tree was the biggie?
Yes, I would go with the tree. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions for Sarah? Okay. Sarah is one of the people who publishes with CFAS as an author, and that's appreciated. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, Elizabeth?
Okay. So under Quick Start, share screen.
And start.
Okay.
Just make it bigger and we're good, ready to go. Station mode.
Okay. So I think the primary highlights that I would highlight are our findings on longitudinal change, that change over time, even during childhood and adolescence, differs between exposed and controls. And I think that's a really important point, and similar to what Kirsty was talking about earlier, that it's not some sort of static damage to the brain, but that things that are going on during development, if it's in the environment or hormones or other things, are impacting these kids over time, suggesting that maybe things like interventions might still even work during the childhood years. And so it begs the question, what is going on in the brain, whether it's changes in activation that differ between groups or in structure. It begs the question of what's going on in there that is impacting why these things are changing differently over time so late in development. So first questions, and these are studies that Christine Dubin has really been showing, is that there are sex differences in white matter microstructure that are influenced by pubertal hormones. So for example, girls with FASD have higher anisotropies and controls, and boys have lower, so there are sex differences that are important to keep in mind. And the sex-dependent differences are dependent on hormone levels. So potentially underlying alterations in neuroendocrine systems that change during puberty may contribute to group differences in brain morphology and white matter microstructure. Another important area that we are hotly investigating is the impact of the environment. And again, it harkens back to Kirsty's talk earlier. But preliminary results are showing that there are positive associations between SNS and subcortical volumes in controls, but not in the FASDs. It's important to note that the associations between both cognitive test performance and subcortical volumes are seen in both groups, such that higher cognitive function and higher SES are associated with larger subcortical volumes. So it's possible that prenatal alcohol exposure may either attenuate positive effects of, so decrease the positive effects of high SES in the exposed group. Those are things that we're sort of trying to investigate now. So why is the impact of SES seem to be less in the exposed group? And we've been looking at both DTI metrics, structural MRI, and we're going into the functional connectivity as well on the impact of SES. So these are papers, under review papers, and I just like to highlight the ongoing work that's being conducted. So we're looking at white matter microstructure and executive function, brain volume and socioeconomic status, white matter microstructure and SES, and then now also going into longitudinal changes since we're coming to an end of the longitudinal component of CFAS-3. We're also doing some interesting preliminary studies looking at sensory motor functioning in some of our CFAS participants, and we're looking further at facial morphology using shape-based analysis through the K-Award of Shantanu Joshi. Abstract. High impact, you know, I don't know, I think this makes sense, but really the high impact of these two commentaries that Ed and Michael and I wrote, it may seem silly to wonder about Teams and Facebook, but it really does impact the societal, the societal influence that we can have as a group. So our commentary in trends in cognitive science is in the top 5% of all research output scored that was published in a similar date. And even though the Nature commentary has a lower sort of societal impact, it's still in the 82nd percentile. So I just think these things are important, and I don't know if we as scientists think about it a lot, but those are, I think, important to highlight as well. And I think that's it.
Yep, you noticed I highlighted those. I do think they are important. So
yeah.
So
let me know if you want more information from the altmetric, because I just cut and pasted, but you can actually cite a little more information if you want.
I may. So what would you say is if you had to highlight one thing?
I think it's just really that change over time differs, and I think that, you know, whether you're looking at brain structure, activation, and we're also working on change in VTI, white matter connectivity, the only explanation of that is that things long after the alcohol exposure are influencing the way the brain is changing. So it's something in the environment. It could be hormonal, which I think Christina Eubin's work is really important in highlighting. And it could be just, you know, kids are behaving differently in their environment, and everything that sort of goes on in the world is influencing the way the brain is wiring, even during, after the age of 5. So that's what I think is really important.
All righty. Any other questions? Okay. Peter?
All right.
This will probably be the last one we have time for, and then we'll have to take off on the next ones at our next conference call. And I know Joanne had to leave early.
I'm here now, but I am about to go. Thanks, Ed.
Okay, so our first goal was about screening tools for faces, and we now have a 3D handheld camera in a FASD clinic in the UK with the picture that, as you can see, takes 3D photographs, and our screening software allows you to interact with the image and automatically generate comparisons of PFL centile and also compare individuals with models that we've generated from CFAS data. Here, look at the whole face, and here for this individual who hasn't got the normal FAS characteristics but has got smooth filtrum. We're adding new techniques to this screening tool, and curvature has been proving to be very effective in doing things that just size difference doesn't do. So you can detect some smooth filtrums with size difference, like on the left here, but on the right the face is so small you can't. But with curvature, which ignores size, you can detect using with this little blue bit on the filtrum, you can actually detect in both faces. So that's the detection. We're also looking to add a quantification of filtrum smoothness, and that's by using curvature to calculate the volume of the filtrum and then generating a measure we call filtrum groove index. And you can compare an individual with normative data, or you can simultaneously compare an individual with the filtrum groove index and the PFL. So you can see against CFAS data where an individual lies in terms of exposed or diagnosed FAS and control. We've also done some work, as you know, with Alison Noble on
extracting profiles from 3D ultrasounds, which we've then been able to show from a shape analysis correlates with the number of drinks consumed during pregnancy, also in terms of correlates with exposure and the second, third of pregnancy. We're interested in looking more in the future at faces, because it turns out that if you're going to also look at differential diagnoses, the nose turns out to be important. So we don't have ultrasound images of differential diagnoses, but we've been able to show postnatally, by looking at three genetic conditions that are differential diagnoses of FAS, that we can distinguish if we use the whole face without a problem. The profile and frills don't do so well, but the nose is surprisingly good. And when you look at the actual, I don't know whether this will work over the bandwidth, but when you look at the shape variation in comparing these genetic conditions with FAS, they really are quite different. On the cusp of moving from CFAS 2 to 3, we've actually done this work separating out the heavy exposure children who couldn't be given an FAS diagnosis into those that were control-like and FAS-like. And then as CFAS 3 began, as a result of the slow acceptance of a paper, which we had to do more work on, and we were able to then make that linkage between the cognitive impairment and the division of the HE into control-like and FAS-like. We've tried to repeat that in the Caucasian population. That previous work I've just showed you was in the Cape-colored population, but we haven't been able to do that because of differences in the measures used in the CFAS different generations. And so that's now become a Cape versus Caucasian comparison, whereby looking at various parts of the face, we've been able to show how well different parts of the face do in terms of agreeing with the clinical diagnosis. And I draw your attention, interestingly, to the malar region, which is surprisingly good, given that it's not something that we always pay a lot of attention to. Differences between Cape and Caucasian arise in the profile in the philtrum, and they're really big differences. They're 12% differences, and we've been able to explain that by showing that the effect on Caucasian philtrum is much more uniform, as you can see from the top of this figure here, whereas in the Cape, it's much more varied and not so uniform, and that explains why you can do more discrimination. Similar thing happened with profile. The effect of alcohol on the profile is much stronger in the Cape group compared to the Caucasian group. These are our papers. I put my interactions as a diagram, and I just wanted to stress that our deliverable in terms of the screening tool and the associated software isn't just used in the FAST-D clinic, but it's used in five other projects of various biomedical applications. And that's it.
Cool. If you had to pick one thing, what would it be?
Well, I think it has to be the screening tool because it pulls everything together.
And about that, let me ask, how operator dependent is it?
Yeah, at the moment, the most you have to do is to put the landmarks on the face, and the rest is automatic.
And then, wow, that's pretty good. All right, any questions for Peter? Okay, well, do you want to do one more, or do people have to go? Is anyone there?
Yeah,
I'm here.
We're all here.
All right, so we want to do one more, or do we want to stop? Anyone have a preference? All right, how about Johan?
Okay. Where is share screen?
Quick start, up on the upper left.
Okay.
Hey, Ed. While Johan's doing that, I do want to throw out that maybe on the next call we should have some time to discuss data access questions regarding CFAS 3 data and maybe everyone can sort of give us an update of where, how, you know, how much data has gone into the repository and plans for data access as we go into phase four?
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea. Everyone can make sure their repositories up to date. That would be great and make it a lot easier for us to discuss that. So, all right, Johan.
All right, so this is just sort of the bullet list of the highlights. So basically, Ben in the lab, when we got into this project, we really needed to know how much ethanol is getting into our zebrafish embryos, so that was sort of the first thing we did. I think the big impact from the lab is the number of genetic susceptibility loci that we've identified. So we've already published actually 6, not just 5, and then we have several others that are being identified right now and characterized. Some of those that we characterized have actually led to analyses because we actually didn't quite understand how the susceptibility locus was impacting normal development, so we had some characterizations based on that. I thought I'd just show a little bit of the data in particular with these, some of the loci that we found. So this is from our publication from the screen that CFAS funded with one of the genes that we became most interested in. So the mutant doesn't look normal, but its head looks relatively normal. We use this dose of alcohol that doesn't change normal development. You add the two together, and then these embryos have a lot of defects. One that's really noticeable to anyone is this eye fusion, so a mid-facial defect. And I think the strength of the genetic approach is that then once we see a phenotype that we're interested in, then we can gain some insights into what's happening. So despite what some people might think, you get cyclopia like this not because you fuse two eyes, but because you fail to separate a single eye field, and we have markers for the eye field. And like in this little wild type, you can see this little curved shape that is separating two eyes. And then you get down here where you've taken away this Bengel tube function and added alcohol, and that shape goes away. And here you can really see that there's this one eye field that's not being separated. So we get some understanding of the underlying cause of the phenotype. We're also trying to understand the molecular nature of these, or the genetic nature of this. So Alfira has been working on transcriptomic analyses where she can take single embryos and perform RNA-seq, so take a look at expression levels of all genes that are being expressed. This is with our dose of alcohol on a wild-type embryo that does not change development. And so some interesting things. So the first in this principal component analysis where each of these little dots is the transcriptomic profile of an embryo. You see in PC1, the majority of the variance is actually explained apparently by developmental noise. The second principal component is what separates the alcohol from the control embryo. So she's been doing some bioinformatics to get an understanding of that, and this is a really big diagram. But just for simplicity's sake, we can find gene clusters, so genes that their expression levels co-vary. And she's found 3 clusters. And then when you take a look at the variables that are in there, these 3 clusters really explain differences that are caused by ethanol exposure. And then we can reach into those clusters and identify the genes that are in there. Some interesting ones pop out immediately. So patch 2, this is in the sonic hedgehog pathway that Scott talks about a lot. And then FAT3 is actually part of the Wnt planar cell polarity pathway, which Bengel 2 is also a member of. So we have some potential insights what might be happening there. We are also interested in taking a look at effects on the nervous system, and I don't know if this movie's going to play for you. So this is, all right, oops, that stopped it. So here is a wild type embryo, and you see these cranial nerves, so these are up in the head, that are elongating out into the periphery. And if this plays, I don't know why this isn't playing. But if I just drag this, maybe you can see that there are a number of defects to these. These are defasciculated axons here. What might be an inappropriate projection here, the trigeminal to the facial nerve here. And so Desiree Buckley is characterizing these defects. And then I would just end with one of the forward genetic mutants that turns out to be in a gene called LRP13B. So this is a gene that we never would have had any reason to believe would be ethanol sensitive, virtually nothing published on it. And it's a member of an LRP gene family. These are co-receptors for a number of pathways that we've found to be sensitive to ethanol, including the Wnt pathway, the Sonic pathway, and PDGF, all of which have ethanol sensitive components to it. So Tim, my grad student, is looking at other LRPs and coming up with novel hypotheses of how this family might be widely ethanol sensitive. So then, I guess, just the product, the publications, I didn't list abstracts, but then this work was resulted in getting some R-level funding, an R01 and an R21, and then some interactions here.
All right. Hey, Johan?
Yeah.
I noticed in the Neuron one, the little movie, that you upped the alcohol dose to 1.5.
Right.
I'm wondering why.
The rationale is that there is a more penetrant effect on the axons at that level. So Desiree, for the movie, since at 1.5%, she usually gets an axon defect. That's what she used it at. So there's sort of a technical challenge here. If we have a partially penetrant effect, where I forget the percentage of mutants at 1% that display it, and so to take the movie, it's actually a challenge. We can do up to 4 embryos at a time, but if only, you know, 10-15% of them have a defect, then you end up with an awful lot of control movies.
All righty. Any other questions for Johan? All right. Well,
nope.
Then let's finish up with the other projects month. But in the meantime, Johan, I mean, it's a lot of good data, but if you had to pick one type of thing to show, what would it be?
Well, I think the most impactful thing is the genetic screening, our ability to go in without a candidate gene approach, just go in and identify genes that are ethanol sensitive, you know, that we might not have predicted otherwise.
So, like I said, we'll do the other projects at the next time. Thank you for the happy birthday. And if I could ask people, it's an easy way for you to get your abstract done over the last, since 2012. That would be great. We just really need a count. I'm not going to put titles or anything like that. But a count would help. If anyone has turned what they've done in CFAS into a K award, an R award, or some other award, if they could send me that information, that would be great. And then again, people that you may have recruited into the field, I think these types of things are important to point out to the review committee.
Ed, regarding the abstracts, I do need the titles because multiple people are going to submit the same ones.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I was going to say one other thing, though. I can't remember what it was. And if you could think you can come up with one slide that really highlights your work, that looks really great, and you want to send that to me for inclusion, consideration for inclusion, do that. Any other comments by the SAB or NIAAA?
No, not for me. I'm good.
Any questions from anybody?
This is NIAAA. I think this was a pretty effective way of, bringing out the highlights. So, well done.
I'm impressed.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Helen, can you stay on for a second?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, just hang on for a second. I just want to ask you a couple questions about the repository. All right.
Sure.